Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Andrea Gammel. My registration number is 32050, and I represent the appellant Ted Herrera in this matter. I will keep track of my own time. I'm hoping to save about 5 minutes for rebuttal. This afternoon, I'd like to spend my time discussing the first issue raised in the brief, which is the district court's refusal to conduct an in-camera review of the female victim's social service records. And I will refer to the relative victims in this case as the female and male victim for privacy purposes. It's undisputed that the social service records that are at issue here are subject to state privilege. And that's under statute CRS section 19-1307. However, the privilege under this statute is not absolute. It contains certain exceptions, two of which are relevant to the issues presented on appeal here. The first one exception permits a prosecutor to access social service records of a victim in the course of his or her investigation of a criminal case. And that's what happened here. Sort of a strange course of events happened, and the prosecutor in this case learned information from the female victim's mother that she had made a prior allegation of some sort of sexual touching. The prosecutor decided at that point that he needed to retrieve the social service records and review them, and he did that. After reviewing them, he realized he had something of a hot potato, and he took it to the court, as he is required to do under this court's Joel decision, and said, "Judge, I've got this material. I'm turning it over to you under seal. It contains this sort of information." And he listed out a variety of things, including information that the records contained evidence which was relevant to the defense's rape shield motion, which had previously been filed. He indicated that there was information in the social service records that may be exculpatory, inculpatory, or impeachment information. And he indicated that he thought the discovery that had been provided to the defense was complete, but after reviewing these social service records, realized that it was not. So using terms like, "It's imperative for me to provide this to the court, he asked the court to conduct an in-camera review of these records and disclose whatever the court determined was necessary for a determination of an issue before the court.
Ms. Gamel, we don't know here in this case whether or not the prior allegations led to a prosecution. Is that correct?
That's right. I believe that the prior allegations did not, because one of the things the first judge, and there were four judges involved in this, so it gets a little funky. The first judge ordered the prosecutor to turn over anything
with an active investigation.
With an active investigation or anything involving a prior allegation that was determined to be false. So I think that nothing came of that, because I don't have any indication from the record that anything was disclosed on that
Thank
matter.
You.
Right. At that point, then, it was in front of the second judge, and the second judge said, "I'm not going to review this material because I need to get an evidentiary hypothesis, some showing of necessity from the defense." And the prosecutor said, "Well, Judge, I'm telling you, you know, there's this sort of information in there, and I have an obligation under Brady versus Maryland to disclose exculpatory and material information to the defense." And the judge stopped and was fairly resistant and said, "No, it's not your burden, you know, it's not your burden to make this showing." And the prosecutor said, "I'm happy to make this evidentiary hypothesis for you that would warrant the, you know, what the court thought was necessary to review the material in camera." The court refused and said, "Defense, you have to file a motion setting forth this evidentiary hypothesis." The defense, being somewhat in a disadvantage here, having not seen the material, filed a motion generally asserting the same sort of things that the prosecutor had said about them, about what the records contained: exculpatory information, Brady material, material relevant to the rape shield motion. The court then denied the motion in a written order, finding that the defense had not made a sufficient showing, sufficient to overcome this initial threshold burden of showing that the material may be necessary for determination of an issue before the court.
Ms. Gamma, what about the Turley case, which I think the trial court judge relied on, because that case does say that a defendant must set forth an evidentiary hypothesis to warrant disclosure of confidential records.
Right, and I think both Turley and the X-Line case, both of which were relied on rather significantly by the district court, at least in the first written order, deal with the situation where the defense is making the request for the materials, and the prosecution is not making the request for the review. So it is, it's a, in those cases, in X-Line, in Turley, it's true that the defense has to make this sufficient showing, this threshold showing of that, one, the records exist, and two, that they may be necessary for resolution of an issue on appeal. And again, this court has said a number of occasions that even in those circumstances where the request is coming only from the defense side, that the court should liberally construe these sorts of requests and review the information, the records, whenever it appears reasonably possible that they may contain evidence that's necessary for resolution of an issue in the case, or evidence that may be discoverable to the defense. What Joelle makes clear, and I think part of the reason that the district court might have got tripped up here, is it was the prosecution making this request, which is a little bit unusual and not something that's discussed in many appellate decisions, because usually if the prosecution is making the request for review, the court does it, so it doesn't become an issue before this court. And so when the prosecution, Joel makes clear that the prosecution may make the request for review the same as the defense does. If the prosecution is making the request for review, the adequacy of the defense request for review is immaterial. In fact, the defense wouldn't have to say anything. If the prosecution has in its hands, which it did here, Brady material, impeachment material, prior witness statements of witnesses directly pertaining to the allegations in this case, things that are clearly discoverable either under Rule 16 or automatically under Brady, the threshold test for in-camera review has clearly been met. It is a low threshold. And the court's refusal to conduct the review in this case seems to stem from its conclusion that the defense had not made the sufficient showing.
So, Gemma, what, let's assume for argument's sake that we agree with your initial argument that the trial court erred in not conducting that in-camera review. So even if we agree with that, why shouldn't we conclude that any error by the trial court was harmless? Because here we have a situation where it's not just a he said, she said. We've got corroboration by the male victim.
Well, I don't think you can ever say that non-disclosure of Brady material to the defense is harmless without having the development of some record below to say, here's what I, one, here's what that information is, or two, here's what we would have done with that information. With respect to the corroboration, my recollection is that this case was quite a, there was an allegation made by the female victim, an allegation made by the male victim. I don't recall from the record there being facts that showed that there was any eyewitnesses or anything to these events that allegedly occurred. It was certainly a credibility case. The female victim had significant credibility problems. Any information which might have tended to impeach her credibility would have been critical to the defense and certainly not harmless under the facts of this case where the evidence was far from overwhelming. So I would say that it is not appropriate circumstance to consider the issue harmless without allowing the defense to make the showing of prejudice.
Could be considered harmless with respect to the male victim?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because one, we don't know. The only person who knows what's in those records is the prosecutor out in Adams County, and he clearly believed that there was a lot in there that needed to be disclosed.
Right, but remember, he was looking at the female's records,
right.
And as you indicated, and the briefs don't seem to indicate there's overlap or corroboration, so why wouldn't there be anything in the records about the male? And it wasn't suggested as much by anybody.
Sure. Here's my response to that. First, as all of us have probably seen social service records at some point, and when the social service agency launches an investigation involving a child, often there is information about the entire family, friends, family structure included in those records. And I think that even the state's answer brief indicates that while it appears that these records relate only to the female victim, there may be information in there related to the male victim as well. And I would add to that that certainly the female victim's allegations, she seemed to be the driving force behind the allegations. The brother, the male victim, came forward only after she made this disclosure. And I have to say that the allegations are a little bit odd in that there are male and female victim in this circumstance. So I think that if her credibility is undermined to such a degree, given that his allegations kind of came in tandem with hers, I think that anything that tending to impeach her credibility or the legitimacy of her accusation would also implicate his the legitimacy of his allegation. And certainly, again, Your Honor, it is one of those circumstances where even Joelle and ADT and other cases from this court indicate the defense has to be allowed to make the showing that it would have changed the result, even with respect to him, because since we don't know what's in there, perhaps there is something in there. Maybe the brother, the younger brother, is in there saying, my brother and sister are crazy liars. I mean, we just don't know. So I think at this point, not having seen what's in there, it's not appropriate to make any determination of harmlessness at this point.
But if those records on remand, if those records are reviewed, I mean, the trial court's duty is to review as to her prior allegations and whether she made any false allegations, not to review everything and engage in a fishing expedition. I mean, that's exactly what has been cautioned against in prior case law, is not to engage in a fishing expedition.
Well, I guess I take exception to that a little bit, and to the extent that the prosecutor's representation about what is in these records is not solely limited to her. He says things like, there's information in there related to the rape shield, which may be more related to the female victim. However, the second prosecutor indicates that there's information in there that would be relevant to the impeachment of the credibility of a witness. So we don't know exactly who the prosecutor was referring to there. And I think certainly for fairness sake, when we're dealing with a case where a man goes to trial on two lifetime sentence cases with knowing now that he does not have Brady material, which is automatically discoverable under the Constitution, we can't make these determinations at this point of any sort of harmlessness or that it's going to be a fishing expedition. The court should be required to review all the materials that are before it to determine what in there might have been relevant to an issue before it and to disclose those materials to the defense.
Are those materials before this court?
They're sealed before this court. I asked for access to the materials and the request was denied. I think probably because the district court has never made the initial determination that the privilege, that it has, you know, a sufficient showing to look at the records itself. So the records are not available on appeal.
I didn't mean.
I'm sorry. Oh, but I think my answer is the same.
Available to us?
Well, under Witry, and I'm concerned, I had some concerns about that. I think under Witry, they're probably not, because
under what?
Witry, W-I-T-T-R-E-I-N, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's discussed in the ADT case, which is in my brief. There's a discussion about whether it's appropriate for an appellate court to review.
Okay, I don't want to take up any more of your time.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's my answer. I will save my remaining minute for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Gallo.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. This case does present an unusual set of circumstances in that we had two requests for the trial court to do an in-camera review of privileged records, both of which wound up being initiated by the two separate prosecutors in this case.
Were there three requests? Were there two requests and a motion for reconsideration?
There was an initial talk about this at a hearing in front of Judge Moss on May 19th. So there was the discussion at that hearing, and the court invited the defense to file a motion, which the defense did on June 4th. There then was a written order which issued on June 30th, 2008, which said that the defense had not made a sufficient showing. It was raised again at a hearing on October 21st. It's odd because if you look at the transcript has Judge Warner's name on the front of it, but it wasn't actually in front of Judge Warner, that it was in front of Judge Wasserman, and there are many references that Judge Warner will be hearing the case. So there's another discussion and a mutual motion by the defense and the prosecutor at this October 21st hearing. And then there's a written denial that's issued by Judge Wasserman. So that's the second written denial. There is, and that happened on October 24th, 2008. There is some additional discussion with Judge Warner immediately before trial. I believe at the pretrial conference and also then on the first day of trial. His conclusion, which I quoted in my brief, was that he really didn't have any more information and didn't have any reason to overturn the rulings made by the two previous judges. So I have the two written orders and, you know, some discussion in the record with the trial judge, but not so deep as to be, to my mind, an additional request for denial.
This is pretty persistent efforts by the prosecution, isn't it, to get the court to look at these records?
Yeah, although we had a big change in personnel here. The original trial prosecutor was Sean May, unfortunately was shot and killed. And so the original request was made by Sean May to Judge Moss, and then another pair of prosecutors, J.P. Moore and Sharon Holbrook, inherited the case and then made a request to Judge Wasserman. So it is unusual, it's part of the whole unusual circumstance in the case, but in answer to your question, I think it's not one prosecutor making continued efforts, but it's a second set of prosecutors in front of a second judge.
Yeah, but why would they? If the issue has been resolved, why would they feel compelled to bring the issue up again before a second judge and perhaps a third time before a third judge?
You know, I think they're very concerned about their responsibilities under Brady and Rule 16. Obviously, they are very concerned.
Is that not sufficient enough to require a judge to at least look at the records?
Your Honor, I think what's required to look at the records is materiality. I think that is the threshold showing that is needed if either there is a defense or a prosecution request. And I don't think that the prosecutor's remarks rise to the level of materiality. If we look at what the prosecutor said, there were some records that were produced, and I'd like to make a quick aside, which is apparently there is no dispute that these records are privileged. I'm not sure necessarily that they're privileged under 19-1-307. Those are child abuse and neglect records. And I'm not sure that these are necessarily child abuse and neglect records. We know that they are social services records. But I would just like to say that in terms that we're talking about a privilege. These are privileged documents. I'm not sure that they are necessarily child abuse and neglect documents. There doesn't seem to be enough information in the record to say exactly their source.
But isn't that exactly the problem? That, you know, the prosecutor wants to make sure that they're in front of the trial court because they feel that it's their obligation under Brady. And they're saying, yes, it could be exculpatory, it could be material. Why isn't that enough, especially when the prosecutor is also concerned with not revealing the contents of those records? I mean, they're also concerned about the protections that should be afforded to them, which is why they're begging the court to look at them.
Well, I think
why isn't that enough?
The prosecutor is uncomfortable with the responsibility, and so I think that the prosecutor is very interested for his own sake in making a full disclosure, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily in the victim's best interest, nor the ultimate resolution of the case. The ultimate resolution of the case, it has to be with the trial court, and I'd like to look at what the defense offered, which was...
Before we go to the defense, let's go back to the prosecution. Should there be a block or bar on the district court reviewing this because the prosecutor perhaps was uncomfortable with revealing more about these records? If they're material...
Your Honor, if they're material, that, I think, is the whole question. The way the records were described by the prosecutor, which was quoted by the defense in the defense motion, is that most of these records are potentially relevant to this case. And it says, for either inculpatory, exploratory, which may be an error, or impeachment purposes. So what we have is a potential relevance. And a potential relevance, I don't feel, rises to the level of materiality. And that's why we need something more. I think that either side, whichever side is the moving party, has to have a threshold showing of materiality. And likewise, when we look at when the matter is revisited.
Is that what Joel says? A threshold showing of materiality?
Joel,
did they use that language?
The language that Joel says is, the prosecutor should explain why public disclosure of the information, quote, is necessary. So I think the is necessary language comes from 19.1307, which talks about being necessary for the determination of an issue. But I think we can only interpret this necessity as being materiality. I think that in order to pierce a privilege, I think that we have to have something that is material. And for that reason,
well, no one is suggesting that the privilege be pierced, are they? They're suggesting an in-camera review.
Well,
to see whether or not it does rise to this level and ought to be disclosed.
But an in-camera review is not appropriate under every circumstances. Otherwise, it becomes, as Judge Fox said, a fishing expedition. What we need is a showing of materiality, whether it's the prosecutor or the defense doing so. And let me return to what the prosecutor said when we were at the October 21st hearing.
Does Turley require a showing of materiality even from the defense?
Your Honor, the quote that I have from Turley, which is at page 502, says that a defendant cannot require the trial court to review privileged records in camera, and here's my quote, without first establishing a basis for his claim that it contains material evidence. So Turley does require materiality.
Do you think they were using it in the constitutional sense of materiality or in the relevant sense of materiality?
Your Honor, I think in the constitutional sense.
And is there anything in the text of Turley that would indicate that to us? Surrounding citations.
Well, in doing so, Turley quotes Pennsylvania versus Ritchie. So I would think that would be a citation, since it's to U.S. Supreme Court law, to constitutional materiality. But that would require, all I can say is that citation is there.
Ms. Roarpaw, given the constraints that are placed on prosecutors in terms of their not being able to disclose confidential information, to what extent, in your view, can prosecutors describe what is in confidential social services records? And I ask that in connection with your comments about materiality.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure what can, and certainly no actual facts can be disclosed. It may be that some sort of hypothetical situations could be presented. And I do want to look at what the prosecutor said at the October 21st hearing, because what the officer said is that the information should be close to the defense, so the defense has it for cross-examination of a witness, which would go towards credibility. But what Turley and the X-Line cases tell us is that mere references to credibility are not enough to prompt an in-camera review of privileged records. Being relevant or going to credibility are not as high a standard as constitutional materiality, which is what I believe is required.
But Ms. Roarpaw, we not only have these statements by the prosecutor that you cited to us, what we also have is the underlying circumstances, which is that the prosecutor went to the mother to find out if this young woman had made some prior allegations of prior sexual abuse. And that's when he started digging in because the mother indicated that that might be the case. So we have that in the backdrop as well. So we can't just take these potentially relevant and, you know, coupled with his concern that he can't disclose too much information. So why doesn't the combination of all those suffice to give us materiality?
I just don't think that you can amalgamate all of the circumstances to become materiality. And it is a funny set of circumstances. I don't know if you noticed, the victim's mother, in fact, works for social services. So she had her own access to court records and files and things like that. So that's just another very peculiar circumstance that the victim's mother is actually a social services employee in this case. And then there's some, as I recall, the initial question was whether there were some allegations that the female victim had been sexually assaulted by the mother's boyfriend. But there's never anything that seems to indicate that this is subsequently a concern. Everybody agreed that only false allegations would be admissible at trial under Rape Shield. And also, it's very clear that the prosecution was told that it needed to disclose any active investigations that involved allegations by the female victim. And those were disclosed, which tends to show that this wasn't what was in the records.
Well, we're not quite sure, because the prosecutor does make a statement that said, gee, I thought discovery was completed, but upon reviewing these records, I guess it wasn't. So the prosecutor seems to indicate that maybe there is discoverable material in there.
Well, he says something about Rape Shield. Now, I mean, there's a whole level of analysis here in terms of there may be information which is discoverable, and there may be information which is disclosed, but under Rape Shield, that doesn't mean that it's admissible at trial. I mean, that would be another level of the analysis, right? That the first part of the analysis is, does the trial court do an in-camera review? Then what is disclosed to the defense? But then there's another whole level of the analysis under ADT, right? If there's something that should have been disclosed to the defense, would it in fact have been admissible at trial under Rape Shield? And would it have made a difference in the jury's verdict? I mean, there's a whole level of analysis beyond where we are.
Yeah, that's right. So that seems to establish a pretty high burden for the defendant in this case or in any similar case. Wouldn't you agree?
Your Honor, yes, I think it is a high burden for a defendant in any case to get access to privileged records. But I think that is as it should be. I mean, what the trial court said in the first written order is, without the explanation of an evidentiary hypothesis, a mere claim that records are potentially relevant to this case would entirely abrogate any confidentiality protection provided by statute. That you can't make it too low a burden, because otherwise that would eviscerate the privilege under all circumstances. So I think it's appropriate that we have a burden, and I think the burden is appropriately constitutional materiality.
But you can't have so high a burden that nobody's going to be able to meet it. And don't we have the added protection that these are not automatically turned over to the defense? The trial court is still acting as, you know, a reviewer. I mean, that's why there's an in-camera review.
Yeah, no, the worry that's expressed in the Joel case with regards to the trial court's role in this is that it would be unduly burdensome for a trial court in every circumstance to have to review everything. And that's why we have to have a sufficient showing. And as I said, that some of the statutory language is as needed or necessity. But I think that what is needed is constitutional materiality in order to trigger a review.
How can the defense show constitutional materiality when it doesn't know what's in there? And back to Judge Taubman's question, how can the prosecution disclose in a public forum, perhaps, the contents of the records to demonstrate the materiality or their potential materiality?
I think, Your Honor, it probably has to do with what the defense theory of the case is going to be. And that's why looking at the Exline case, cited in Truly, is probably appropriate, because in that case, there had been a specific allegation that the victim was fabricating her story, that she was fantasizing based upon prior sexual experiences, and that made what the defense sought disclosable to the defense. So I think probably, yes, the defense has no way of knowing what's in the records, but probably some allegation that it's relevant to the defense as the defense is intending to pursue a trial would be what would be necessary and appropriate.
Not necessarily materiality.
No, I think materiality, but I think materiality would be established by this hypothesis, which would include what the defense intends to use at trial. And I think the prosecutor made a comment about that when he said at one of the hearings, gee, I don't know what the defense is going to be, so I don't know if this is going to be relevant to them or not.
Ms. Rohrbaugh, your time is up. Thank you very much for your argument this afternoon.
I thank this court. I'd ask you to refer me to the recommendation.
Your Honor, it's just a couple quick points here in the seconds that I have. Materiality, whether it's required or not, is clearly established in this case. When the prosecutor says he's got Brady material, Brady contemplates that that material is exculpatory and material. So we know that material in this case is material. We also have him representing that there is impeachment material, as the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, can make the difference between conviction and acquittal. Clearly material evidence in this case.
Well, is all impeachment evidence material evidence?
I guess it could be on a minor point, like you said, you know, you wore a blue shirt and today I'm wearing a red shirt, you know, some minor factual point like that. But certainly in the context that it's being discussed here, where the prosecutor is making representations that there is evidence that is necessary for impeaching a witness, that would be material evidence. Second, also to the extent that the prosecution is arguing that maybe this is not even privileged to begin with, then I think we have another problem and another alternative basis for relief here, which is then the prosecutor was automatically required to disclose this material to the extent that it was Brady material under Brady versus Maryland.
Ms. Gamble, I see your time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you very much for your presentation as well. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.